please stand for the scripture reading this morning, which can be found on page 351 as we read 1 Kings 19, 7 through 13. The angel of the Lord came back a second time and touched him and said, "Get up and eat, for the journey is too much for you." So he got up and ate and drank. Strengthened by that food, he traveled 40 days and 40 nights until he reached Horeb, the mountain of God. There he went into a cave and spent the night. And the word of the Lord came to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He replied, "I have been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, broken down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I am the only one left, and now they are trying to kill me too." The Lord said, "Go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." Then a great and powerful wind tore the mountains apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake came a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire came a gentle whisper. When Elijah heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. Then a voice said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" This is the word of the Lord. Please be seated.
On this second Sunday of Advent, I'd like to begin our time with two quotes from Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a German pastor and theologian during the 1940s, during the Nazi occupation of Germany. He writes, "We have become so accustomed to the idea of divine love and of God's coming at Christmas that we no longer feel the shiver of fear that God's coming should arouse in us. We are indifferent to the message, taking only the pleasant and agreeable out of it and forgetting the serious aspect that the God of the world draws near to the people of our little earth and lays claim to us." Bonhoeffer writes about how we have become accustomed to Christmas. We expect it to come each and every year. It's on our calendars. We anticipate it. And because we have become so accustomed to it, it's lost its impact. It's lost its power. The radical nature of God's love coming as a baby in a manger becomes normal to us. And that's why we have decided this Advent season to pause, to pull back, and to walk slowly down the hallway of the Old Testament, as we talked about last week, to walk slowly down that hallway of the Old Testament and see that people waited for thousands upon thousands of years for God to be revealed, that for millennia upon millennia they had caught glimpses of God's character. They caught little sights of him in a burning bush. Or last week we saw in a smoking fire pot, they caught little glimpses of God. They saw pieces of his character. Prophets said, told people about him, and they told that one day these pieces of his character, of which you've only caught glimpses, will one day be fully revealed. The choir just sang about it. And the glory of the Lord will be revealed. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken it, and the prophets prophesied. But then what happened? People waited. And they waited, and they waited, and the world grew very dark and dim, and they caught little sparks occasionally of God's presence, and they wondered as they waited, would he ever fully appear to us? Bonhoeffer goes on to write, "Whoever does not know the austere blessedness of waiting, that is, of hopefully doing without, will never experience the full blessing of fulfillment." And so we are going to intentionally go slow this Advent season and wait. Because when we know the austere blessedness of waiting, come Christmas Eve, when we see Jesus revealed in his fullness, we will experience on a deeper level that blessing of fulfillment. So let's look at 1 Kings chapter 19 together. There have been times in all of our lives when we have said the following two words: too much, too much. It goes on our lips even early on in our lives when we experience hardship and suffering and a weight on our shoulders that we feel like we can't bear, and we cry out, too much. I remember being a little boy in the third grade. I'd already repeated kindergarten, and I came to the third grade a little later in life than others because of my repetition of kindergarten. But the reason that I repeated kindergarten was I had some trouble with my fine motor skills developing. And so I did kindergarten twice in first grade and second grade. And then I got to the third grade, and there I am in the third grade. And the writing thing is still not working out very well. And I remember sitting there, and the test would come, and I would stare at it and go, oh no, not again. So much in my head and so difficult to get it out on the piece of paper. And I would just look up and I would just go, it's too much. It's too much. I can't bear this pain anymore. And all the kids in the class would be, you know, finishing their tests, and I'd be just, you know, the first quarter of it, and I would just go, it's too much, God. How long is this going to take to work itself out? We all have a little bump or bruise or hurt like that from childhood where we said too much. They continue on into adulthood. I got married. And I remember within the first few weeks of me getting married, I realized something. I'm a lot more selfish than I thought I was. Nino realized he's a lot more selfish than I thought he was. Who was this guy that I was dating? Where did he go? Why did he all of a sudden get so consumed with his wants and his needs and his desires? And I remember when I finally came face to face with this and saw what my selfishness in marriage was doing to Nina, and realized the real work on my character that I would have to put in order to change. You know what I thought? Too much. Too much. Change. Can I be that different? Can I really be that different? Can God really change me in those ways? Can I give this up? It's too much, God. I don't know if I'm going to get there. Later on, fast forward a little later in life, I remember Nina coming to me saying that she was pregnant with our first child. And I remember being pretty nervous about this. I was a seminary student. We were just scraping by. The first thing I did after I learned that we were pregnant with our first child, I went to the online bank account, you know, banking online, pulled it up and thought, this is going to be expensive. This might cost too much. I better see how much I have for this too much expense that's about to come into my life. And I opened the online banking statement, and we had $10 to our name. I thought, oh, it's too much, God. It's too much. How are we going to get through this? How are we going to make it? Fast forward a little more. Last year, I was the interim. I know, it just keeps going. You can relate. Everyone can relate. Starts early, keeps going all through life. Last year, I was the interim pastor here at the chapel. And I remember exactly where I was. I was on Richmond Road, and the corner of Richmond Road and Old Town Road, and I got a call from Phyllis Leffler, and she said Dick Woodward had passed away. And I remember just looking up to heaven and crying out, it's too much, God. Dick was such a stabilizing force in my life, such a great mentor, someone that no matter what was going on here at church, that I could go to him and say, Dick, here's what's happening, and I need some advice, I need some wisdom from someone who's been there before. He would just sort of flatten everything out, normalize things. He was a stabilizing force, I think, for our whole congregation to have him available. He preached multiple sermons for us during that interim time period. And then he passed away in the middle of it before it was complete. And I remember just thinking, it's too much, God. This is too much. We can't handle another bump in the road. It's too much. But the good news is, we're not the only people throughout history to look heavenward and cry out, too much. If you look at 1 Kings 19, verse 4, Elijah is sitting under a broom tree. He's fearful for his life. He's running away. He's out in the middle of the desert. And we read these words, I have had enough, Lord. And a literal translation, I think, has even a deeper punch to it. In the original Hebrew, it's just two words. too much. It's too much, God. That's what Elijah says to God. He's running away. He's in the middle of the desert, and he looks heavenward, and he says, it's too much. When I cry out too much, when you cry out too much, when Elijah cries out too much, God has an answer for us. And the answer is renewal. Anyone who's crying out too much is in need of renewal. And 1 Kings chapter 19 asks and answers two questions about renewal. The first question it asks and answers is this: why do people need renewal? Have you ever wondered that? Have you ever wondered why you get to those points in life and someone passes away or the job gets lost or something doesn't go the right way at work and you cry out too much? Do you ever wonder how you get to that point? Why? Why do people need renewal? And the second question that 1 Kings 19 asks and answers is this: how does God renew his people? And along the way, we will catch two glimpses of the manger together. So first, let's look at this question: why do people need renewal? In order to understand why people need renewal, you have to understand the connection between 1 Kings chapter 18 and 1 Kings 19. Because if I just read you chapter 18 and said, hey, predict what Elijah's attitude is going to be like in chapter 19, you would never get that he's sitting under a broom tree in the middle of the desert alone crying out too much. You just wouldn't get that. Because in 18, he is at the pinnacle of his profession. He's a prophet among prophets. He's just won the Super Bowl showdown of prophet matches, you know. He went in the octagon and he won the match. He had a showdown with the prophets of Baal, 450 prophets of Baal. And God shows up big time and shows that the Lord, the God of Israel, is the one and only true God, and shows Elijah to be one of his true prophets. And at the end of chapter 18, there's a drought that has happened. And God told Elijah, hey, you pray for the drought to end and it's going to end. And Elijah kind of looks at Ahab and says, you want to see something? And he prays for the drought to end. And all of a sudden, Ahab can see the rain clouds coming. And Ahab is the wicked king of Israel at this time. He's going, this is a powerful man. This guy's really in charge. And you see at the end of chapter 18, you see Ahab gets in a chariot and rides off back to Jezreel to tell the queen Jezebel all that happened and how the prophets of Baal were murdered by Elijah. And what does it say at the end of 18? It says, as Ahab gets in the chariot to ride off, Elijah, this is 1846, the power of the Lord came upon Elijah, and tucking his cloak into his belt, he ran ahead of Ahab all the way to Jezreel. He beats out the chariot. That's how on top of his game this guy is. And then we see that Jezebel, this queen, she sends a messenger to tell Elijah, hey, you killed my prophets, I'm going to kill you. And we see in 19:3, Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. Let me ask this question. With everything I just told you about, all that went well for Elijah in chapter 18, why does he crumble so quickly? Why does his life just fall apart with one messenger that says some threatening words to him? Well, you see, the seeds of burnout are always planted long before the burnout actually happens. Our need for renewal doesn't come in a moment. It seems like it comes in a moment here, but if you go back and read chapter 18 closely, you'll see why Elijah is burned out, why he cries out too much, why he's in need of God's renewal. And it really starts in chapter 18, verse 20. You see it clearly in 18:22, but it starts earlier in the chapter. So in 18:22, as Elijah is about to announce this contest between the prophets of Baal and himself, Elijah says, I am the only one of the Lord's prophets left, but Baal has 450 prophets. That's Elijah's mantra. I'm the only one. And we're going to see that later on in chapter 19. When earlier on in the passage, if you go back to 18:1-4, there's a man named Obadiah. And as we get introduced to Obadiah, we are introduced to the fact that he loves the Lord. And he has actually preserved a remnant of 100 prophets. He's taken 100 prophets that Jezebel was trying to kill. And he's hidden them in two different caves. And so you think, oh, well, maybe we should cut Elijah a break because maybe he doesn't know what Obadiah was up to and that there are really 100 other prophets left, that he's not the only one, except for the fact that in 1813, Elijah and Obadiah meet. And guess what Obadiah says to Elijah? He says, haven't you heard, my Lord, what I did while Jezebel was killing the prophets of the Lord? I hid 100 of the Lord's prophets in two caves, 50 in each, and supplied them with food and water. Oh, Elijah does know about all these other prophets, yet he's claiming to be the only one left. You see, burnout happens. People need renewal when they begin saying, I am the only one. That's what happens. Why do people need renewal? Because as people, we are prone to say, I'm the only one. I'm the only one who can do that job. I'm the only one who can rescue that person. I'm the only one who can save my son or my daughter. I'm the only one, and it all depends on me. I'm the only one that can do it. Don't you see? I'm the smartest person in the room here. Don't you get it? I'm the only one. And the weight of someone saying, I'm the only one, it weighs so heavily on them. You see what it leads to. Look at 19:3. It leads to Elijah is afraid. He runs for his life. It leads to fear. Then Elijah comes to Beersheba, and he says to his servant, you stay here. I'm going out alone. Then it leads to isolation. Then Elijah cries out to God, take my life. Extreme cases, when someone is saying, I'm the only one, it leads not just to fear, not just to isolation, it leads to despair of life itself. And so I think it would behoove us all to just ask the question, where in my life am I saying, I'm the only one? Where in my life am I taking on that weight and saying, I am the only one? And I'll just ask a follow-up question. What's the result? Are you experiencing peace? If not, and I suspect not, Jesus offers us all renewal. And the rest of the passage shows us how he does it. So let's move from why people need renewal to how God renews people. You see, look with me at the second half of verse 5. You're going to see how God starts to renew people. There's a theme that emerges. All at once, an angel touched him and said, get up and eat. He looked around, and there by his head was a cake of bread baked over hot coals and a jar of water. He ate and drank and then lay down again. The angel of the Lord came back a second time and touched him and said, get up and eat, for the journey is too much for you. So he got up and ate and drank. Strengthened by that food, he traveled 40 days and 40 nights until he reached Horeb, the mountain of God. There, he went into a cave and spent the night. See, step one on God's path to renewal for us all is this. God pushes people to eat and sleep. It's really crazy stuff. Really stuff you couldn't come up with, you know, a simpler solution. But this is what God does for people, because oftentimes we miss the simplest yet most important step on a path to renewal. God pushes people to eat and sleep. See how often it happens in this passage. Elijah, the angel wakes him up. He says, you need to eat something. The angel provides him with food and water. Then he lays down again. The angel comes back a second time and says, you need to eat again. You need to eat more. Then Elijah goes on this journey. He gets to Horeb, and we'll talk about this later, but Horeb is the same place as Sinai. The words are interchangeable. It's just a different name for Sinai. When he gets to Horeb in verse 9, what does he do? There he went into a cave and what? Spent the night. He goes back to bed. If you're feeling burnout and in need of renewal, I recommend two things, eating and sleeping. Does anyone remember our fall study from this past year? We studied a book called The Good and Beautiful God. And one of the reasons we chose this book, we thought the content in the book was good, but we thought the soul training exercises were great. We thought, we don't just want to learn more and stuff our head more with facts. We need something to do to practice things that God has asked us to do that will help draw us closer to Him, to make Him a part of our everyday lives. And I just went back over those soul training exercises. There were 9 of them. Let me read 5 of them to you, and you can see what theme emerges. This is 5 out of the 9. Margin, sleep, silence, solitude, slowing down. You catch a theme there? 5 out of the 9 soul training practices all had to do with hitting the pause button in our lives. Just hit the pause button and let God start to minister to you, to eat a meal quietly and alone and not try to multitask during the meal. A 6th soul training discipline was Psalm 23. So I gave you 5 that were directly related to hitting the pause button. And then Psalm 23, we were supposed to pray Psalm 23 all week. And how does Psalm 23 go? The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not be in want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He doesn't recommend I lie down. He doesn't suggest I lie down. He makes me lie down in green pastures. So many people, I hear this, there's this whole idea, I hear about it, I do it too myself, that we watch 2 screens at once. You're watching TV, and I watched a commercial the other day, and the commercial didn't make any sense. It was like, you want to see the end of the commercial? It was a John Hancock commercial. It was like, you got to go to this website. They're assuming that people are watching multiple screens at the same time. It's too much, my friends. It's too much. It sort of gets our mind going and going and going and going when we need to pause and do one thing at a time. And let God begin to renew us that way. Step 2, after God pushes people to eat and sleep, God forces people to get honest. And this is that great question that's in the passage that Tommy read for us. In the second half of verse 9, we read this, "And the word of the Lord came to him, 'What are you doing here, Elijah?'" What a great question. What are you doing here, Elijah? And then there are all these powerful signs and symbols, and we'll come back to these. God is not in the wind. He's not in the earthquake. He's not in the fire. He's not in the pyrotechnics show. He's in this gentle whisper. And then God asks the question again a second time. What are you doing here, Elijah? Why does God ask the question 2 times? Because God is forcing Elijah to get honest. He's saying, really think about your answer, Elijah. Really think how you got here. What are you believing about your life that has you in this place where you're in despair, that has you in this place where you need renewal? And if you notice, Elijah's answer to the question, what are you doing here, is the same answer before God reveals himself through the gentle whisper and after God reveals himself through the gentle whisper. It's not a very good answer. He says, I've been very zealous for the Lord God. And guess what? I'm the only one left. He's still saying I'm the only one. So God is not going to let it stand. God does not let it stand. And that's why the passage ends in verse 18. God says directly to Elijah, "Yet I reserve 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed down to Baal and whose mouths have not yet kissed him." You're not alone, Elijah. I'm going to ask you a question to prod you into the truth, but if I have to, I'm going to force you to be honest. I'm going to force you to be honest, Elijah. What I love is this passage, God helps Elijah confront his false narrative. Elijah's false narrative was this narrative of I'm all alone. False narrative was another big theme from our fall study. I talked to a friend this week. I noticed a pattern that had developed in their lives a little bit, and I noticed that it was starting to become kind of a steady pattern. So I went to them and I said, hey, I just want to point this out, and I don't want to try to solve this problem. I don't want to pressure you, and I just want you to hear me out, and I want you to consider admitting that this is a problem. It's the whole idea of step 2, God forces us to be honest. And so I sort of laid out my case for this trusted friend. We have a great relationship. And they looked back at me and said, I hear you. But I could tell it was kind of painful for them to admit that they heard me. And I said to them, I said, what false narrative are you believing that's making this hard for you to come to grips with? And this person talked about the way God gifts people. And they were believing that if they were really gifted by God, that this really wouldn't be an issue in life. And I said, that is such a lie. You have been gifted in amazing, brilliant ways over here. And you're looking at this part of your life saying, I'm putting blinders onto the way God has gifted me, and I'm believing that, oh, because I have a problem here, that God hasn't truly gifted me. I said, that is a false narrative. You need to get out of your mind. And when God seeks to renew us, he's got to replace our false narratives with true narratives. He wants us all to answer the question, what are we doing here? God's great question, what am I doing here? And I love that it can be asked and almost perceived a lot of different ways. It can be asked kind of, how did I get here? What destructive habits brought me to this place? Or what lies am I believing that got me here? And I would just ask as a point of application, would we all have the courage this week to get quiet and alone and say those words to ourselves? What am I doing here? Or if you want to step it up a notch, maybe ask a trusted friend. They probably know what you're doing, stuck and in need of renewal. Ask a trusted friend, and you will begin walking God's path of renewal. The next step that God has as he renews people is God draws people into his presence. Notice in verse 11, when the presence of God is about to pass by, God gives Elijah a command. He says, hey, go stand out on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by. But when the whisper comes, and that's where God's presence truly is, notice where Elijah is in verse 13. When Elijah heard it, that's the whisper, he pulled his cloak over his face and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. God says, Elijah, I'm coming. Stand out on the mountain. And Elijah stays in the cave. And there's, like I said, there's the smoke and the fire and the earthquake, and none of that draws Elijah out. And so God knew with all the turmoil going on in Elijah's life, with the dearth of peace that he was experiencing, God knew that he could only draw him out with a gentle whisper. The phrase in Hebrew, it's a kind of a beautiful wordplay. It's not a gentle whisper, it's the sound of silence. That when you put those opposing words together in the Hebrew language, it means a very small voice, a very fine sound. There is a sound of silence. And in the midst of Elijah's turmoil, that peaceful sound of silence drew him out into God's presence. As we talked about last week, God shows up in practical ways sometimes. A smoking fire pot was a common item in the ancient world. It's a common item in the third world today. God is trying to draw you out of the cave with his presence if you will look for him and see what methods he might be using to draw you out. Step number 4, God puts people in community. Remember, Elijah's original problem was what? I'm the only one. And so the solution needs to be more than God telling Elijah there are 7,000 people in Israel who have not bowed their knee to Baal. He actually puts Elijah in community with some of those people. Look at verse 15. The Lord said to him, go back the way you came and go to the desert of Damascus. When you get there, anoint Hazael, king over Aram. Also anoint Jehu, son of Nishimi, king over Israel. And anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat, from Abel-Mehaloiah to succeed you as prophet. Jehu will put to death any who escape the sword of Hazael. And Elisha will put together any who escape the sword of Jehu. See, God forms a team for Elijah. He puts him in community and says, you are going to have practical reminders like Jehu, like Hazael, like Elisha, someone that's going to succeed you. Practical reminders around you that you are not in it alone. See, God pushes us to eat and sleep. He forces us to get honest. He draws us into his presence. He puts us in community. God is in the renewal business. One of the final verses of Scripture, Revelation 21:5, we read these words. Jesus says, he who was seated on the throne said, I am making everything new. God is in the renewal business. And if you will take steps with him today, he will renew you, for I am the only one, and place you in community, reveal his presence to you, give you the rest that people only find in him. Well, along this path, we talked about the idea that we'd see two glimpses of the manger. Where are they? The first one is in verse 5b, the second half of verse 5. We read this, all at once an angel touched him and said, and then in verse 7, we read the angel of the Lord came back a second time. There is high drama in the second half of verse 5. We miss it in the English translation, but if you were making a movie, this would be an incredible scene. I'll tell you why. What did Jezebel send to tell Elijah that she was out to murder him, that she was out for blood? She sent a messenger. Okay, the word for messenger in both Hebrew and Greek, it works the same way, an angel are the same. It's the same word. So there's a messenger that is out to get Elijah. Imagine there's a hit put out on his life, and then you get to the second half of verse 5, and you read, all at once an angel touched him. You're reading that, you're going, all at once a messenger touched him or an angel touched him. You have no idea if this is from God or if this is the man that's sent to kill him. All at once, an angel touched him, and you're sitting there in suspense watching him eat this bread by the fire, going, is this guy going to just run him through or what? Imagine that scene. I love thinking of the Bible as a movie sometimes. The man disappears from sight, and he comes back in verse 7. And in verse 7, you read, oh, it's the angel of the Lord. This is God himself who has shown up to minister to Elijah. So God appears in verse 7. Well, he appeared in the second half of verse 5, but we weren't sure it was him. And then in verse 7, we see that God himself appears. And what does he do when he appears? He feeds Elijah. And this is where we catch the glimpse of the manger. Well, Luke is telling his Christmas story in Luke chapter 2. We read three different references to a manger. Luke wants to make sure we know exactly where Jesus is. The angels show up to the shepherds. They say, hey, here's the sign. He's lying in a manger. Before that, Luke told us that Mary, after the baby was born, she put him in a manger. Then the shepherds go off to Bethlehem to find him, and it makes sure that we know they found him doing what? Lying in a manger. See, a manger is a feeding trough. A manger is the place where God's creatures come to eat. What does God do when he shows up in Elijah's life, when he appears to Elijah? He feeds him. And what does God do when he shows up in the ultimate theophany of Jesus? He feeds his people. The manger is a call to feast on Jesus himself. It's a call to the ultimate banquet that we will one day be a part of in heaven, that we can feast on him, his words, his body, his blood. God longs to feed his people. And Jesus in the manger is a sign of that ultimate feast. And we catch a glimpse of it here as God appears to Elijah to feed him. Glimpse number two is the gentle whisper. In order to understand glimpse number two, you have to understand that this whole chapter has been setting up similarities between Elijah and Moses, and between what's happening right now and Sinai. And if you'll pull that slide up for me, there's similarities to Sinai happening all throughout 1 Kings 19. The first one is this. In verse 8, we learn that Elijah travels 40 days and 40 nights to get to his destination. It's the same amount of time that Moses spent on Sinai. Then in verse 9, we read that Elijah spends the night in this cave. In the Hebrew, there's actually a definite article. The writer of 1 Kings calls it the cave. Remember, we talked about that last week. There was a cave where God hid Moses as his presence passed by. So Elijah is in the same cave, not just the same time he spent on Sinai, but he's in the same place where Moses was on Sinai. And then verses 11 through 12, when we read about the wind, the earthquake, and the fire, if you go back to Exodus 19 and you see the signs that accompany the giving of the law, there's an earthquake, there's a fire that descends on the mountain, thick smoke. They're all the exact same signs. But what happens? God's not in any of those signs, is he? He's in the gentle whisper, the still small voice, the sound of silence. And the glimpse of the manger is this: God's presence does not come as he would expect, as we would expect. This is the lesson of God coming as a baby. All powerful yet helpless, all knowing yet speechless, the riches of all the kingdoms of the earth at his disposal, yet born into straw poverty. God's presence, which knows no boundaries, confined in a stable. We glimpse the manger because we glimpse the unexpected presence of God, not in fire, not in an earthquake, not in wind that splits rocks. We glimpse the unexpected presence of God in a gentle whisper, and we glimpse the full presence of God as he comes to us as a baby confined in a stable. We glimpse the manger because we glimpse the unexpected. God wants to renew each and every one of us. I pray that we would be renewed at his table. Will those helping me serve communion please come forward?